Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the September 2nd, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about capitalism's cycle of inequality and a short story by Kate Walbert, and a few other short things. I'll begin today with a poem by Tony Hoagland, entitled Among the Intellectuals. They were a restless tribe. They did not sit in sunlight, eating grapes together in the afternoon. Cloud watching among them was considered a disgusting waste of time. They passed the days in an activity they called thought-provoking, as if thought were an animal and they used long sticks to poke through the bars of its cage, tormenting and arousing thinking into strange behaviors. This was their religion. That, and the light shining through the stained glass ancestors. They preferred the name of the tree to the taste of the apple. I was young, and I wanted to prove myself. But the words I learned from them transmuted me. By the time I noticed, the change had already occurred. It is impossible to say if this was bad. Inevitably, you find out you are lost, really lost, blind, really blind, stupid, really stupid, dry, really dry, hungry, really hungry. And you go on from there. But then you also find you can't stop thinking, 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 tormenting, and talking to yourself. And now, from the fiction section, a short story, To Do, by Kate Walbert. Her mother had been a beauty, a green-eyed blonde who wore a long braid down her back in high school, and in college, Vassar, 57, in New York, Katie Gibbs, 58, and her job in the typing pool at Westinghouse, before she was asked, actually told, to adopt the more stylish updos of the time. She refused, her boss accusing her of hysteria, though the origin of the word, do you know this, is the once belief that the uterus could reach up its bloody hands and grip the throat. Constant addresses the mostly silent women, many from her department, who have gathered in the Antlers Bar on Elm, near the Loop, for the new Storytelling Wednesdays. The audience is silence, not silence, but agitated, bored distraction, as Constance closes with a recitation of her mother's to-do list. One of many she found among her mother's things last spring, upon her passing, she's explained. Cirrhosis of the liver, but that's another story. This list was picked at random from a drawer in the condo's kitchenette. Her mother, in one of those retirement communities, haunted by women and men at the end stage, although whoever saw the men? The men were parked in different hallways, narrow, wallpapered corridors lined with orchids. Constance says, miles and miles of orchids. She continues, the wallpapered walls hung with Wyeth and Rockwell and Turner prints. The corridor's labyrinth, windowless. I was always lost, she tells the silent women. They gave me 3 weeks to clear everything out. Presto, pronto, goodwill, hello. No condolences from the staff. And these lists. Everywhere, on the backs of envelopes and cardboard coasters, pharmaceutical notepads, post-its in different colors and scraps of watercolor paper. She likes to paint, liked to paint. And anyway, everything. So much to do, lists and lists. The crowd's silence is the same weight she senses in class sometimes when she wanders to a different topic, or at a dinner table when she's had too much wine. I call it, she says, clearing her throat, to do. And she adds, I hope everyone will get the picture as someone scrapes her chair back and angles toward the bathroom. The others watch the woman's progress, riveted. A few performers later, Beth, Constance's colleague, stands bare-chested, center stage, spoons balanced on her nipples, her medium essentially visual. She had said, by way of introduction, we would do it at the football parties. It was a thing. And here a visual reimagining of my lost youth, she concluded, unbuttoning. Now she kills the same crowd, the women wildly applauding as Beth looks up, her face flushed even from this distance, or perhaps it's the lights. They flood the makeshift stage, flood Beth, the glare of them casting her as something other, something more. Is she wearing face paint? Has she grown a third eye? One silver spoon drops to the floor, and the crowd collectively gasps. Her mother's to-do list went something like this. Bleach, yarn, Q-tips, blueberries, call Constance, organize girls, ask William. Constance had read each item slowly, deliberately, clarifying a few details. William, her mother's ex-husband, Constance's father, long deceased, girls, she and her younger sister, Sally, she supposed, all the while on stage thinking, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? Her performance had lasted no more than a few minutes, but the weight solidified into a rock you might split open with a hammer and a chisel. It had all to do with saying something, Constance told herself, with continuity and mothers, lists, and identity. In short, are we the sum of what we've crossed off? Or are we only what we still have left to do? Her mother's death wasn't the point. People died every week at that place, every day of the year. Mothers, fathers. In her mother's retirement community, they printed, embossed, the names of the newly dead on ivory cardstock each morning, and propped the card as if it were a menu on a tiny easel outside the dining room. Dinner specials, her mother called them. Death du jour. When Constance used to visit, which she'd done less often than she would like to admit, she steered her mother clear of the easel and wheeled her straight to the employee who manned the dining room door. We have a standing reservation, her mother would say, a joke or coquettishly, table for two. And they would laugh and laugh. Now Constance gestures to the waitress for another drink. She wants it quickly before the loudly applauded Beth returns from the stage. Although Beth appears to be going nowhere, the audience whistling as if to summon dogs. Earlier, Beth had ordered a green tea and warm quinoa with kale. Protein and grains, she explained, and no to wine, thanks. One glass will make her fuzzy-headed in the morning, and Beth wants none of that. She's having none of that, apparently. She had smiled. Sorry, she said, I'm a boring date. Where is camaraderie? Constance wants to know. What happened to camaraderie? Tonight's out. To bonding. To drunkenness. All these young women, so lean and muscular and accomplished at 30, Ivy Leagued, Brazilian waxed, thonged, tattooed. She pictures her little sister Sally, thonged, tattooed, bending down to wipe the chin of one of her numerous children. Tattooed. Sally. Jesus. Antlers is a university bar. Odd for downtown, off the loop with its streets of neon pizza establishments and old Polish restaurants, marble-floored, near-embalmed waiters, odd so close to the lake, where on certain nights, such as this one, the wind tunnels down Sheridan, up Oak, pummeling the glass-wrapped new condos and bending the spindly sycamores planted in tree boxes on oak and willow and maple until they nearly snap. Here, Antler's many-mullioned windows seem oblivious of weather. The glass plastered with peeling team mascots and political stickers. The walls dense with important persons in black and white, most already forgotten. Their capped smiles wide and white. their hairstyles reflecting each decade, a visual medium. A severed head of an elk, the bar's inspiration, its dark eyes dulled, its fur patchy, and antlers obscene, stares down from the end of the narrow hallway to the bathrooms. The bar, decidedly male and unaccustomed to such a throng of females, or to the waft of estrogen rising like mist, its makeshift stage, not a stage exactly, more a dais of the kind used for elevating politicians above a crowd. Look now at Beth as she takes another bow, all the colleagues reluctant to let her go as she waves goodbye to the left, goodbye to the right, spoons in hand and blouse fortunately buttoned up. Groups of women, some strangers, offer high fives as she threads through the tables. Constance watches, then turns to Beth Kinwa, a hearty, fiber-esque gray. She pictures opening her mouth and blowing, setting the entire place to flame, or at least reheating the Kinwa. She could do it, too, given what she's put down in the course of the past hour, given her general mood. A little fire would bring a swift end to storytelling Wednesdays. We're all about inhibition, Marianne, the MC, recently tenured and flushed from the publication of a best-selling dystopian novel, announced at the start of the evening. Losing it. Or possibly creativity gaining it, reclaiming it, owning it, she added. Her own story, kicking things off, had to do with her firstborn, a cesarean section, the doctor's hand deep in her gut, a recurring feeling even after he'd sewn her up, even after her newborn was a toddler, those hands still there, rooting around. Amazing, Constance says to Beth, who slides with a jaunty handoff from Marianne back into her seat. You liked? Beth says. Loved. Completely loved. Insane. How did you even do that? Practice, Beth says. Muscle memory. Tim thinks it's a hoot. Beth holds two familiar-looking spoons in her hand. Your quinoa's cold, Constance says. I know, Beth says, scooping and chewing. It's supposed to be, well, not cold exactly, but not hot. Hot is too much. Lukewarm is best. Well, I completely agree, Constance says. Another mother story, not that anyone's asking, a day long ago, summer of 1980 or thereabouts, Constance scrounging for spare change and possibly a cigarette in one of the cloisonné boxes in the living room. Constance is a teenager in tennis whites, a big match that afternoon. The living room is a room she rarely enters, sanctioned as it is for weekend gatherings of adults. They come in pairs, like monogamous swans arriving for her parents' famous cocktail parties, chit-chatting among the heavy walnut furniture, the coffee table with its twisted vined legs, the tiger oak sideboard laden with silver she and Sally polished the day before Thanksgiving or Christmas Eve. On the walls are the artifacts from her parents' collections, her mother's framed Hans Christian Andersen illustrations torn from a valuable ancient edition, a flea market steal. The little match girl shivering and a near-dead Hansel and Gretel. And splayed on the living room couch, one arm across her eyes as if against a glare, her mother out cold. No Constance has come into 13 like Juliet Capulet, lovesick, desperate, a pawn in the vagaries of jousting boys. She keeps a diary under lock and key and rarely tells anyone her true thoughts. How she alone can see the way the world tilts and slips off its axis. The way no one understands a thing but her. She feels in her bones that she will reinvent the universe in the image of something better. Something as of yet unimaginable, but far beyond the horizon of this failing world. She will, she believes, just as soon as she gets out. Now, she loops her mother's arm over her shoulder and drags her up the stairs. Soon, the bridge group arrives, clustering in the foyer, bags and shoes, expressions. They are here for their weekly game, they tell Constance, who has answered the door. They were on for 11, they say. And isn't that her mother's car still in the drive? Who knew? Who didn't? Constance's mother was once not so far from the rest of them, if measured by this and that yardsticks or swizzle, but now she has soared straight to space, shot to the moon, tucked into bed where Constance has lugged her. Mother's upstairs, Constance says. She's under the weather. Oh, it's going around, Margaret Jones says. I believe she knew we were coming, Florence Spears says. I told her I'd play her hand, Constance says, improvising. I'm not bad. I've been teaching myself. She's been teaching herself, Taffy Bott says, as if Constance were speaking French and she must translate for the rest of them. Constance smiles and holds up the cards, tall in her tennis whites, her legs and arms tanned. She explains that they can play a rubber, maybe two, but she has a match in an hour and will have to cut it short. She has her mother's eyes. They'd never notice. And a way of looking as if she might rip their throats. No doubt she has a killer serve. Sally arrives to offer lemonade, 10 cents a glass. All right, they say. If you're sure, they say. Everything almost fine, and what isn't can be ignored. Constant subbing for her mother. Little Sally selling lemonade. Florence Spears tells a funny story. Taffy Bott shows them her broken toe, the bruise reaching all the way to her calf. Margaret Jones has a summer cold, but who doesn't? Constance sets up the card table in the middle of the living room, the folding one from the garage, still sticky with the spills from Sally's stand the weekend before. She sends Sally for a tablecloth from the kitchen, cocktail napkins, a can of peanuts from the pantry. The women eat the nuts in fistfuls, down their drinks quickly. The cocktail napkins read, "Of all the things I've loved and lost, I miss my mind the most." Beth walks Constance to her apartment, one of the nondescript new condos on Sheridan near the university. They burrow against the wind in their puffy, ugly coats, too cold to speak until they reach the shelter of the courtyard. "Do you like a nightcap?" Constance asks her. "I've got midterms," Beth says. "Right," Constance says. "Forgot," she says. "Sabbatical, hey," she adds, her explanation these days for everything. "Well, good night," Constance says, pulling open the heavy outer door to the vestibule. "You were great," she calls to Beth, as the door slowly closes behind her. Within the vestibule, there are the usual takeout menus and free newspapers scattered on the tiled floor. And someone has once again covered the buzzer panel with stickers advertising a locksmith. "Call Phil," the stickers read, again and again. There must be 100 of them, or hundreds. Phil everywhere. Constance reaches into her pocket for her key, a single key unadorned. She likes it that way, though her ex-husband Luke is convinced she's a fool. "You're a fool," Luke tells her every time she fishes her single silver key out of her pocket. "A fool." But there's no key, only a piece of paper, a list, folded over and over again as if top secret. The ink faded through clearly her mother's hand. "To do," it reads. "Bleach, yarn, Q-tips, blueberries, call Constance, organize girls, ask William." "What did I miss?" her mother wants to know. She lies in bed, eating the buttered toast Constance has delivered on a tray. There are smells here beyond the homey toast, her mother's smells, and the cold smell of the big black telephone next to the bed, where her mother and father sleep, lying straight and still, side by side. Her mother's clothes are lined in the closet by color, her sweaters zipped into moth-proof bags, and in the third drawer, behind the box with her mother's rings and pearls, the bottle of gin Constance found foraging for cigarettes weeks earlier. She had swigged some of it for good measure, and then poured most of it down the drain in the master bathroom. The counter cluttered with her mother's makeup and perfumes, the mirror smudged in places as if mother had pressed her face too close to the glass. "Nothing," Constance says. She has played her match, returning straight home. Somewhere between here and the club, she saw a flattened armadillo, its splintered shell streaked with brown blood. Someone must have dragged it to the dirt. She stinks of sweat, dried to salt. If you licked her, you could survive for a while, but not forever. She has won her match in straight sets. In fact, the few onlookers, other girls' mothers, said they had never seen Constance serve so well. Constance playing as if her life depended on it. Her opponent, a taller, older girl named Macy Levitt, her glasses hooked with a needlepoint band, thought at first that Constance wasn't Constance at all, that somehow in the time between now and before, Constance had been replaced with a different Constance. Not the Constance Mary Levitt knew from the past, but a Constance from some distant Amazonian tribe. "So you're the famous Phil," Constance says. He's arrived, as promised, driving up in his big truck, as if this were the country, idling for a while, the truck's headlights illuminating her, casting glare and shadow on the glass door, the frozen courtyard, the withered rhododendron. "Yes, ma'am," Phil says, pulling out a ring of keys, a bowling ball of keys. "Well, good to meet you," she says. "Same," he says. Phil is stunningly handsome. She wouldn't have predicted it at all, but the world turns in mysterious ways, as her mother would have said. Her mother would have also said, "There but for the grace of God go I." Hindsight is 20/20, and better than canned beer. "Ma'am," he says. She's been drifting, apparently. Sabbatical haze.
"Yes?"
"Done," he says, and she resists correcting his grammar as she's inclined to do. "A turkey is done," she might say to him. "You are finished."
"Really? Wow! I mean, I wasn't exactly watching, but that was fast."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Well, I'm glad you left your stickers all over the place."
"Yes, ma'am." The man was irritating, but the rest of him she liked. She remembers the story of her friend from college who invited the UPS guy in. This was exciting back then. A man wearing a brown and yellow uniform on your doorstep, ringing your doorbell. Goodies packed in large cardboard boxes.
"Well, how about a drink?" she asks Phil. "Would you like a drink? A nightcap? I was just going up, and boy, you really saved my ass. No one answered the buzzer. The whole world is out. I mean, I have a cat and my son. Well, he's with his father tonight, but he would have totally freaked if I couldn't get in to feed the cat."
"It's his cat."
"Well, sure."
"What?"
"Sure, I'll have a drink," Phil says. "I've got coverage."
"Coverage? Great."
Phil holds the vestibule door open for her and then follows Constance into the elevator and out into the brightly lit floor, lines of doors on either side of the long hallway, strangers within. It's Chicago real estate of a certain kind. Thin walls, thin glassed windows that leak heat in winter, the radiators blasting like nobody's business. Here, the little match girl looks entirely out of place. Constance has kept the print through college and graduate school. Its twin, Hansel and Gretel, lost to a moldy basement in Oakland, unrecoverable. It is very late when Constance finds herself naked from the waist up, attempting to balance spoons on her nipples.
"Something we used to do at football parties," she lies.
For the entertainment of the locksmith, Phil, a man to whom she had already recited her mother's to-do list, hoping for a better reaction than the silence of storytelling Wednesday. Phil had come through. He applauded heartily.
"You get it," she said. "You get it."
They have finished the bottle she found in the refrigerator. Their sex vigorous, inspired, or what she remembers of it. The couch wide enough for both of them, though she preferred the floor. Now, he watches the spoons, which she has, after several attempts, muscle memory, she explains, finally mastered. They balance from her nipples like silver icicles.
"Neat trick," Phil says, buttoning up. "I'll teach my wife."
Constance could eat Macy Levitt for lunch. She could pummel her with aces, lunge the net, drive the ball down her throat. She pictures it clearly. "Think like a winner," her coach is saying. Her coach, a woman whose name has been engraved countless times on the trophies in glass outside the ladies' lounge.
Baby Rollins, first place, ladies singles. Baby Rollins, first place, club championship. Baby Rollins and Fran White, first place, etc., etc. She beats Macy Levitt in straight sets. She makes Macy Levitt cry. She makes Macy Levitt throw off her glasses and stomp them with her traytorns, losing the needlepoint band in the crabgrass next to the court, its fine handiwork sucked up and shredded by the power mower a few days later, the driver entirely oblivious. She makes Macy Levitt quit the junior varsity team, and years later, when she learns that Macy Levitt has been hospitalized for anorexia, she wonders if she also made Macy Levitt do that. Constance reheats the coffee. She shuffles the stack of business cards Phil has left behind. What's with this guy? Outside, a bright moon and far below the scurry of late-night students, home from the library, the clubs, other dorm rooms. The university is taking over this neighborhood, once a place of revolutionaries and poets, men and women who labored in the slaughterhouses, whose fathers and mothers escaped lives so unspeakable they never spoke of them. Their languages, their etymologies submerged in the rising tide of English. Their customs obliterated, or at least that's what the public said when the public weighed in, person after person waiting for her chance at the microphone. But no one listened. And here's another mother story, the part Constance doesn't like to tell, the reason for all this mother business. Why her mother is here again, as she will always be here again. Vassar girl, Katie Gibbs girl, a ghost perched on the narrow faux brass railing of the balcony, good only for the cat litter and the trash. Constance is too lazy to take down, a ghost stepping out of Hansel and Gretel, shaking the dead leaves from her sweater, still confused as to what path she was meant to follow, or maybe haunting the corner with her last match. "What I miss," her mother says, after complimenting Constance on her presentation. Constance has folded a linen napkin, one of her mother's favorite floral ones, next to the plate, and sliced some bananas into a bowl. She has poured a glass of milk and picked a daylily from the long drive, put the flower in a silver bud vase. She wants everything nice. But as she watches her mother's hand shake, holding the toast, a feeling of pity, or rather revulsion, reaches up to tighten its hold, to grip her throat. It's a feeling Constance knows from catching her mother alone in padded bra and girdle, her mother's blue-white skin, the frayed straps of her complicated undergarments Constance has seen drying in the master bedroom, slung over the metal shower rod. So Constance does not say nothing, as she sometimes remembers, cruel, cruel child that she was, that she continued to be. Instead, she waits, fingering the grass stain on her tennis skirt, a smudge of dirt on her wrist, her animal smell rank, furious. "Everything," is what she says, looking back at her mother, whose green eyes, rimmed in red, stare out so hungrily. "You missed it all," she says. And now, from the Department of Finance, an article entitled "Widening Gyre, the Rise and Fall and Rise of Economic Inequality" by Liaquat Ahmed. In 1831, Alexis de Tocqueville, at the age of 25, was sent by France's Ministry of Justice to study the American penal system. He spent 10 months in the United States, dutifully visiting prisons and meeting hundreds of people, including President Andrew Jackson and his predecessor, John Quincy Adams. On his return to France, he wrote a book about his observations, Democracy in America, the first volume of which was published in 1835. Many of the observations have weathered well. He noted, for instance, how American individualism coexisted with conformism. Others have not. For example,
Tocqueville, who was the youngest son of a count, was deeply impressed by how equal the economic conditions in the United States were. It was, at that time, an accurate assessment. The United States was the world's most egalitarian society. Wages in the young nation were higher than in Europe, and land in the West was abundant and cheap. There were rich people, but they weren't super rich, like European aristocrats. According to Unequal Gains, American Growth and Inequality since 1700, by the economic historians Peter H. Lindert and Jeffrey G. Williamson, the share of national income going to the richest 1% of the population was more than 20% in Britain, but below 10% in America. The prevailing ideology of the country favored equality, though to be sure only for whites. Americans were proud that there was a relatively small gap between rich and poor. Can any condition of society be more desirable than this? Thomas Jefferson bragged to a friend. Today, the top 1% in this country gets about 20% of the income, similar to the distribution found across the Atlantic in Tocqueville's day. How did the United States go from being the most egalitarian country in the West to being one of the most unequal? The course from here to there, it turns out, isn't a straight line. During the past two centuries, inequality in America has been on something of a roller coaster ride. An early systematic attempt to chart the evolution of inequality in this country was undertaken by Simon Kuznets, at that time a professor at Johns Hopkins, who, in 1955, published what turned out to be a seminal paper, Economic Growth and Income Inequality. Drawing on years of assiduously collected data, for which he later won a Nobel Prize, he reached a surprising conclusion. Like most economists, he had assumed that the general trend in a capitalist economy governed by private property would be for the rich to get richer, for inequality to increase steadily over time. That had been true in the initial stages of industrialization, he found. But since then, the United States, England, and Germany had experienced a narrowing of economic disparity. And as more data from about more countries became available, Kuznets found that in most advanced economies, the poor were catching up with the rich. It was, he said, a puzzle. The explanation appeared to involve two factors. First, there was the rise of mass education. Once countries had reached a certain level of industrialization, skills, human capital, became as important as physical capital in determining productivity. And a greater economic share accrued to those with more education, not just to those with money to invest. Second, politics took over from economics. The poor, with the weight of numbers on their side, realized that they could vote in favor of taxing the rich more heavily, redistributing the money to themselves in various ways. Kuznets' own life seemed to illustrate how education could raise the income of the poor. He was born in 1901 into a Jewish family, grew up in eastern Ukraine, and at the age of 21, during the Russian Civil War, fled to the United States. There, he obtained a doctorate in economics from Columbia and became the preeminent economic statistician in the country. The inverted U-shaped relationship that he found between income and inequality, inequality rising in the early stages of development and then falling afterward, came to be called the Kuznets curve. As Kuznets determined, it was after the American Civil War that the gap between the rich and the poor began to widen. The concentration of incomes grew during the Gilded Age and eventually peaked during the Jazz Age, when the share of income going to the top 1% reached 20%. Then, during the next 25 years, inequality began to decline, until, by the time Kuznets was writing, it was back to the low levels of the early Republic. Kuznets' article came out at the height of the Cold War. The U.S. economy was booming. More and more people were going to college, white-collar work was taking over from blue-collar work, and During the Great Depression, the government had introduced programs such as Social Security and unemployment insurance. Americans took comfort in the fact that they were that their version of capitalism was not only the most dynamic and productive economic system in the world, but one that was steadily becoming more equitable and fair. It seemed as if they had a problem of inequality licked. It was the era of what came to be called the Great Compression. By the 1970s, America was as equal as any of the Scandinavian countries are today. And then, starting sometime in the early 80s, inequality started to rise. The shape of the curve went from an inverted U to something more like an N, up, down, and up. Nor was this shift a temporary aberration. It has continued for nearly four decades. The jump in inequality has been most dramatic in the United States, where the share of income going to the top 1% has soared from 8% in the early 80s to almost 20% today. But inequality has also increased in Britain, Australia, Canada, large parts of Europe, and even Japan, suggesting that there is something systematic at work across the world. At the same time, there have been some affluent countries, notably France and the Netherlands, where inequality has barely budged. Economists are still arguing about the reasons for this reversal. One important factor, they mainly agree, was the opening up of China, Eastern Europe, and other less advanced regions to world trade. Another was the liberalization of capital markets. Rising import competition hurt employment in domestic manufacturing and held down wages. Most economists also agree that changes in technology have put unskilled workers at a stark disadvantage. What they disagree about is the role of government policy. Rising inequality coincided with a profound shift in economic policy throughout much of the advanced world. In the 1970s, productivity growth in advanced economies stalled. Unemployment rates jumped, and inflation rose and remained obstinately high. And so, in one country after another, political parties got elected by promising to cut tax rates, free up markets, and reduce government intervention in the economy. The change was most pronounced in Great Britain and the United States after Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan took office. But it also occurred to varying degrees in continental Europe, Canada, Australia, and Japan. The story of this transformation is the subject of Benjamin Applebaum's The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. It is a tale that has been told before, but Applebaum adds flesh to the narrative by recounting it through the lives and careers of a small group of economists associated with the University of Chicago, including the Nobel Prize winners Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Gary Becker, and Robert Mundell, who were behind the shift. At the center of Applebaum's lively and entertaining chronicle is the towering figure of Friedman. Well, figuratively speaking, he was a diminutive 5'2". He loved nothing more than an argument, and unlike many of his colleagues, he was a brilliant communicator, able to convey his points in plain English. He published a bestseller, Capitalism and Freedom, in 1962, created with his wife Rose the PBS television series Free to Choose in 1980, and had a column in Newsweek for nearly two decades. When Friedman joined the economics department of the University of Chicago in 1946, it already had a distinctive philosophy, going back to its founding in the previous decade, which involved a belief in the efficacy of free markets and skepticism about the benefits of most government intervention. This orientation had initially put the department outside the mainstream, but under Friedman's intellectual leadership, it went on to become the most powerful economics department in the country, shaping monetary policy, the calibration of exchange rates, the enforcement of antitrust rules, and the setting of tax rates. 30 Nobel Prizes have been awarded to people who taught or were taught in the department. Today, Friedman is acknowledged as the most influential economist of the second half of the 20th century.
An old joke has it that an economist is someone who wanted to be an actuary, but lacked the charisma. The Economist Hour should help to dispel the myth that economists are invariably dull. Although, as it happens, Friedman did intend to become an actuary when he graduated from Rutgers in 1932. A live wire from the start, he conformed to another, more accurate, professional stereotype, namely that economists are know-it-alls. It's something to do with the analytical prism through which the discipline views the world. Friedman advocated freely floating exchange rates because he thought that no policymaker would know better than the market where to set the right rate. Yet he himself could not resist the temptation to second-guess the market. At one point in the 70s, he grew convinced that the liberal profligacy of Pierre Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, would cause the Canadian dollar to fall, and sold the currency short. When the Canadian dollar instead rose by 13%, Friedman was forced to admit he'd been wrong and cut his losses. Another of the colorful characters who populate the Economist Hour is Robert Mundell. Applebaum credits him with providing the theoretical underpinnings of the idea of a single currency, making him, in effect, the intellectual father of the euro and of supply-side economics. In the late 60s, convinced that inflation was heading upward, Mundell bought a rundown 15th-century palazzo in the Tuscan countryside for $10,000. He turned out to be right about inflation and later claimed to have multiplied his investment 100-fold. Yet, 3 decades later, when he won the Nobel Prize in Economics, he was still shoveling cash into his Italian money pit. The Economist Hour is a reminder of the power of ideas to shape the course of history, a heartening thought for those of us in the ideas business. But why did the free market policies promoted by Applebaum's principles spread across the world? One reason was that they led to improved economic growth for a while. Yet, international competitive pressures played a role too. As the world economy opened up in the 1980s, newly mobile capital tended to flow to places that offered the highest return, and very often these were countries with the lowest taxes and the least onerous regulation. To hold on to capital, countries found themselves forced to match the free market policies of their trading partners. There is ample evidence that this shift, in turn, led to more uneven income distribution. Countries with larger tax cuts experience bigger increases in inequality. Applebaum's book, focusing on the who rather than the how, does not delve deeply into these consequences, but they are richly detailed in Capitalism Alone, The Future of the System That Rules the World, by Branko Milanovic. Even though inequality began to rise after 1980, it took economists a couple of decades to really notice. Among those who turned their attention to the fallout was Milanovic, who grew up in communist Yugoslavia, spent a couple of decades in the research department of the World Bank, and now teaches economics at the City University of New York. Milanovic originally built his reputation in the late 90s when, using a giant World Bank database of household incomes, he was able to demonstrate how the benefits of globalization had been distributed among different classes across various groups of countries. The big winners were the global plutocrats, whose returns on capital shot up, and the new mass middle class of the emerging world, mainly in East Asia and India, who benefited from the spectacular growth of their regions. The big losers were Western middle-class workers whose income stagnated as the industries they worked in were hollowed out by foreign competition. Hence, the visceral appeal of Donald Trump's protectionist measures against China. Milanovic isn't just a whiz at number crunching. He has a whimsical, wide-ranging appreciation for history and culture. He has written about income distribution in the early Roman Empire. Inequality during the Augustan age was roughly comparable to that of the United States today.
The effects on European soccer, when limits on the number of foreign players allowed in club teams were lifted, the richest clubs became even more dominant in their leagues, and the financial implication of Elizabeth Bennet's decisions in Pride and Prejudice, marrying Mr. Darcy, would put her in the top 0.1%, while as a spinster she would have fallen from the top percentile to about the 50th percentile. Capitalism alone builds on Milanovic's previous book, Global Inequality, which came out in 2016. Indeed, so many of the themes and ideas in the new book were prefigured in the last one that ideally the two should be read together. In Global Inequality, Milanovic traced the fluctuations of inequality back to the Middle Ages in Holland, Spain, and Italy, and showed that inequality has been going up and down in long and unpredictable waves ever since, responding to various contending forces. In the 14th century, for instance, the Black Death led to shortages of labor, which drove up wages in Italy. In the 20th century, two world wars and the Great Depression destroyed a generation's worth of capital, causing the incomes of the rich to plunge. Surveying all the data, Milanovic concludes that there seems to have been some sort of cap on inequality, a limit to the economic divisions a country can ultimately cope with. The rise of inequality in the United States during the 19th century, its subsequent fall during the middle decades of the 20th century, and its resurgence in the past four decades provide an example of the wave at work. Kuznets had come up with his inverted U-shaped curve only because he had focused on too small a slice of history. In Capitalism Alone, Milanovic turns from the past to the future. With the rise of the emerging economies of Asia, he says, we now have two alternative forms of capitalism operating side by side. One is the liberal meritocratic version found in the West and the championed by the United States. The other is political capitalism, the less democratic and more authoritarian variant, which has taken shape most notably in China. Like all schematics, this one elides a lot of details, but it provides a useful conceptual frame. In the liberal meritocratic world, inequality arises from the way capital is accumulated. The rich are able to save more than the poor, and thus to own a disproportionate share of the capital and the wealth in the economy. Since the return on capital, a major source of income for the rich, tends to be higher than the growth of wages, the rich become richer. Also, as potent is the way the benefits of education are distributed, rich people tend to be more highly trained and can earn higher salaries. They are also able to earn higher returns on their capital, since their wealth gives them greater tolerance for illiquidity and risk. In addition, they tend to marry other rich, educated people and are able to pass on more capital to their children, thereby perpetuating inequalities from one generation to the next. The political capitalism of China has its own inequality-generating dynamics. Although China has become capitalist to the core, almost 80% of the country's industrial output is produced in the private sector, the commercial classes are under the thumb of a highly disciplined autocratic bureaucracy. The rule of law is attenuated, decision-making can be arbitrary, property rights are not fully secure, and corruption is endemic. China is essentially going through a hugely accelerated version of the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age all rolled into one. Add to the insidious impact of cronyism, and a very unequal society results. Income distribution in China, it turns out, is even more skewed than in the United States, approaching the sort of levels one finds in the plutocratic republics of Latin America. What does all this mean for the future of global capitalism? Milanovic finds little on the horizon within either system that would curb the trend toward greater inequality, let alone reverse it. Despite the subtitle of his new book, though, Milanovic wisely trains his attention on the past and the present, steering clear of grand predictions. As he has pointed out, the economics profession has an abysmal track record when it comes to seeing into the future.
Attempts to make predictions about societies are, in his view, inherently doomed because of the contingencies of human events. To have predicted that a decline in inequality was going to happen in the first part of the 20th century, one would have had to foresee, among other things, the onset of a global conflagration in 1914, and even as late as 1913, almost nobody did. The problem with thinking in terms of waves or cycles is that doing so creates a false promise of predictability. Take the stock market. People often characterize it as something pulled between bull and bear markets. But, as anyone who's tried to time the market knows, it's almost impossible to predict how high a wave might go or how long it could last. The contours of stock market cycles become discernible only once they are over. The same seems to be true of inequality waves. That's why Milanovic pointedly ended one of his earlier books with a quote by the poet Konstantin Kavafe. Men have knowledge of the present. As for the future, the gods know it, alone and fully enlightened. The enormous influence of the Chicago School helps explain why research into inequality and income distribution was long sidelined in this country. As Applebaum shows in The Economist's Hour, the Chicagoans concentrated on understanding how to make markets function more efficiently and scanted distributional issues, even though, ironically, Milton Friedman's thesis advisor was Simon Kuznets, and his first job after graduate school was doing research for Kuznets on income distribution. At Chicago, the prevailing view of inequality was that it wasn't a bad thing. It spurred people to work harder and become more self-reliant and self-disciplined. Milanovic, by contrast, belongs to a new generation of data-driven economists who have helped track what has happened to income distribution in recent years. They happen to include an unusually large band of French economists, among them François Bourgeon, Thomas Philippon, Thomas Piketty, Emmanuel Saez, and Gabriel Zucman. It's not for nothing that they come from the land of égalité and fraternité. The cohort of European economists, including Milanovic and the French Brigade, are following in the footsteps of de Tocqueville. They have been able to hold up a mirror so that we Americans can better see ourselves. They've also succeeded in focusing public attention on the issue of inequality. They consciously moved away from quantifying inequality with opaque statistics such as the Gini coefficient, and instead popularized more readily understandable measures, like the share of income going to the very, very rich. The phrases, the top 1% and its obverse, the 99%, became potent political rallying cries during the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011, and concern for the problem hasn't dissipated. Inequality is a major political issue in the lead-up to the 2020 presidential election. Democratic candidates are airing proposals for wealth taxes, steeper income taxes, more biting inheritance taxes, and a better social safety net. That's another heartening reminder of the power of ideas to shape the course of history. And now from the talk of the town, Earth First Department, End Zone, by Henry Alford. The recent legalization of human composting in Washington State has left many feeling squirmy and distracted. So let's take a moment to air our concerns about this novel form of eco-burial. Please feel free to unburden yourself of any knee-jerk thoughts typically ascribed to 14-year-old boys. Yes, you in the back, in the red shirt. Would you start by briefly outlining the process of human composting for us? Human composting is an accelerated form of decomposition by which a corpse is placed in a vessel with wood chips, alfalfa, and straw. Oxygen is pumped in to increase thermophilic or heat-loving microbial activity. After a month, a corpse will yield about a cubic yard of fluffy soil, which will then be given to the deceased family or to a conservation group. The process, which will cost $5,500, uses an eighth of the energy that cremation does. People who have suffered from prion diseases will not be eligible.
Anyone else? The man in the cap? Why not just use an Instant Pot?
Fair enough. Recently, a correspondent called Instant Pot's toll-free helpline and asked if a human body could be decomposed in one of its products. A representative said, oh, this is something I need to check on. He offered to transfer the call to a technical support. If you don't mind me asking, he said, do you have an Instant Pot? The correspondent said yes. The representative asked, can you tell me the model? The correspondent could not, as he was calling from his office, not his home. A woman in tech support was able to answer the question. No, she said. You'd end up cooking the body instead of decomposing it. You'd have cooked meat.
We have time for one last question, ma'am. What about us Catholics? Would being composted consign us to a dank and loamy permalimbo?
The Washington State Catholic Conference has denounced human composting, suggesting that it's an undignified end for a human body. But Father Dick Sparks, a Paulist priest in Vero Beach, Florida, said that a case can be made for it. Given that Pope Francis wrote Laudato Si, a big encyclical about climate control and the environment, I could see human composting being accepted by the church as long as it's done with love and integrity and not primarily for money. Thank you all for coming. Ashes to ashes, dirt to dirt. We have time for one cartoon. We see a lady sitting at a park bench eating her lunch and a squirrel holding up a large acorn. The squirrel says, could you open this for me? We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.